Шо, ребята, как дела? Шо, тиха украинская ночь, да, как говорил великий украинский писатель Гоголь? Все ли у вас хорошо, ребятки? Нравятся ли вам наши байрактары?
Ой, у лузі червона калина похилилася. Чогось наша славна Україна зажурилася.
Hello and welcome to the Ukrainian Provcast, a series of conversations providing Western listeners with the background, context, and history to understand Russia's war on Ukraine. I'm Sam Bach, and with me as always is my co-host Mike Williamson. Today we're going to be talking about the energy situation in Europe, the rest of the world, and how we got here. So to begin, what exactly is going on in Europe? You might have heard, but there are severe energy shortages to the point that there is rationing, an increase in price, of the energy commodities, and the premiership of Liz Truss, one of the shortest-serving prime ministers in UK history, was brought down in part due to her response, her political response to the energy crisis that is hitting Europe and Great Britain, obviously, in her case. So you might have also heard that Russia is playing a geopolitical game with its energy supplies. So today on the Ukrainian Provcast, we're going to be talking about all these things and how we got here and the Russian influence that brought us to this point.
Thank you for that brief introduction. Yes, so I can tell you from experience, living in Northern Europe at the point now, that energy prices, electricity specifically, is about three times what it is in the United States because all of Europe has basically wed itself to Russia over the past decade, specifically Russian natural gas. And this has been used as a geopolitical tool. In no large part, we are here because of the energy vice grip that Russia has managed to manufacture around Europe. We are now at a point that predominantly secular Europe is praying to the gods for a warm winter. So to your earlier point, Sam, how do we get here? Well, it goes back quite a long way. Russia has always had a wealth of natural resources. It's basically been, as it was coined earlier by, I think, Mitt Romney, it's a gas station with an army. So they've long used this as a tool to leverage their neighbors and have built many, 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 many pipelines into Europe, the two largest of which went through Ukraine back in the Soviet era. And ever since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Russia has made it a point to build its new pipelines circumventing Ukraine so that Ukraine can't extract, you know, revenue off of the transit fees. And just in the event that, you know, they decided to assert their military muscle in the area, they'd be able to, you know, basically do what they're doing now.
Purely hypothetically speaking, of course.
Purely hypothetically speaking.
Exactly. Yeah, so let's the pipelines are a big deal, but I actually want to kind of take a step back and discuss, because the pipelines originated as a result of political decisions. They didn't just spring forth from the ground fully formed. You know, in Europe, we'll get to their culpability in all this in terms of their energy policies, which didn't really take any exploitation by the Russians. But one thing we want to touch on first and foremost, kind of the centerpiece of this episode, the money shot very early on, to use a bad metaphor, is the reporting that has been done, which is the Russian boosting of green movements in the West, specifically to wedge Europe to Russian energy, which allowed it to exert the influence that we're seeing today. So there's been some reporting going way back. One piece that we used a lot in this in the research for this episode was from 2014 from notorious right-wing hate machine fake news, The Guardian. I'm being sarcastic here. with the headline, Russia, quote, secretly working with environmentalists to oppose fracking. And you'll see as we kind of go through this episode that this has been a long-term Kremlin strategy to get Western Europe to avoid producing sustainable energy domestically such that Western Europe would come to rely on Russia for its energy needs, which, as we see today, has allowed Russia to exert political influence over Europe, even while, on the other hand, it's invading parts of Europe.
Now, I don't want to paint the picture here that the green movement is like just a Russian propaganda machine. This was a pre-existing thing that the Russians saw opportunity in and sank their claws into it and attempted to boost it. People probably miss the quotes, but there was a point in time where Putin himself, as American fracking was really rolling, he was likening the practice of fracking to like being worse than pedophilia, something like that. He had lots of speeches that were just basically calling anyone who supported fracking like a demon of a human being.
The quote exactly was, Putin says shale oil technologies are, quote, barbaric.
That's basically what it is. And this is relevant because there's actually a ton of shale oil in Europe. It's now, for reasons of like geography and population density and technology, they can't extract it as readily and as easily as we can in the United States, but it is there. And with some investment, they could probably get there. And if they were to do that, they wouldn't be beholden to the Russians nearly as much as they have been. Now, at this point, again, like the Russians have basically cut off the majority of their gas. Some countries have been cut off completely from Russian gas and have seen their prices spike as a result, and they're attempting to drive a wedge between NATO countries, EU countries, and Ukraine with this.
Yeah, so want to kind of add on two additional points to what you're saying. One is make reference to the famous economic paradigm of what's known as bootleggers and Baptists, in which there's a coalition built between a morally righteous side and a scheming, conniving side, both of which aim to achieve the same policy goals. So the classic example is in the name, bootleggers and Baptists. During Prohibition, bootleggers wanted alcohol to be illegal because it was in their business to sell illegal alcohol, making enormous profits that they wouldn't be able to do in legitimate industries. Meanwhile, Baptists, had righteous moral aims to make sure that there was no liquor sales and, cleanse the blight of alcohol in society and everything like that. But the end result was that these two sides, unwittingly on the Baptist side, but wittingly on the bootlegger side, work together. So I think that's I think that framework is very helpful to observe, to think about the green movements with Russian support. Now, before we get into that, I want to just provide a few quotes from this article that we referenced, which really kind of helps drive home the security analysis that that kind of paints the green movements as receiving Russian help. First quote was from Anders Russman, the Secretary General of NATO at the time, and he said, quote, "Russia engaged with NGOs, non-governmental organizations, working against shale gas to maintain European dependence on imported Russian oil and gas," which is what more you need there. That is a security analysis from NATO that says, no, the Kremlin was doing this sort of thing to foster dependence on Russian oil and gas.
I was going through some, basically a Russian propaganda database. It's like a full enabled search engine for this sort of thing. And you could see over time, the Russian propaganda machine went from, singing the praises of Greenpeace or the Sea Change Foundation or all these other green energy movements, to reversing and calling them fascists and Hitlerites and everything the second that these movements criticized the Nord Stream pipelines as they were being built. The Nord Stream pipeline being the major pipeline from Russia to mainland Europe. It does not go through Ukraine. It was specifically built to circumvent Ukraine. So as soon as opposition fomented against this very important project for them, the propaganda machine completely changed its tone. So you can tell there was intent behind the messaging. There was intent behind the funding.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's, when Mike and I were doing research and kind of initially talking about this episode, the point of doing this was to show to a lot of listeners in the West that some policy that they may advocate with all the best moral intentions has geopolitical knock-on effects that they may not have considered. And, by trying to foster the green energy movement in the United States and Europe, obviously, specifically in this episode, there were some really disastrous unintended consequences that led to a head-on collision with their other, with other aims they want, namely the fact that they don't want Ukraine to be invaded. But by engaging in these policies, it led the groundwork for Russia to more confidently invade Ukraine by virtue of the fact that, you see it today, and we made reference to it at the top of the episode, Russia's ability to exert leverage on Europe and, really have them in a vice grip by constraining their energy supplies has given the Kremlin more latitude in its warfighting policies than it probably would have had otherwise.
Yeah, a hell of a lot more confidence in making that initial decision to invade, that's for sure.
Yeah. If there's anything else you want to touch on at this point, we can move on. But I did want to read just a couple of other quotes from the article, just really to drive the point home.
Why don't you go ahead and read those quotes? I have some other stuff I might piggyback with off the back of that.
Great. So in that same article, there was another quote, this time from a unnamed NATO official, but high up per the article, which is, quote, "Russia has been using a mix of hard and soft power to create a campaign of disinformation on energy. In general, the potential for Russia using energy supplies as a means of putting political pressure on Europe is a matter of national security concerns. As energy supplies are an issue for the EU, the EU should consider the new security realities in Europe and look to diversify their energy sources and expand their energy infrastructure. It is in the interest of all NATO allies to be able to have adequate energy supplies for both economic and security concerns. We believe that Russia could try to obstruct possible projects on shale gas exploration in Europe in order to maintain Europe's reliance on Russian gas." And, not to go too heavy, but you really see right here, this is not just an energy concern, this is not just an environmental concern, but these things all get muddied together and turn into a geopolitical concern, which, again, as I said earlier, has allowed Russia to mount the invasion that it did.
So I do feel the need to repeat once more, just so we're absolutely clear, what our goal with this episode is. We are not here to bash green energy or renewables per se. That's not the point. The point is we as in the collective West, we contend here is that we have unnecessarily left ourselves open to this sort of malign interference from bad actors. And we haven't necessarily made a dent. This maybe goes a bit beyond the scope of the episode. We haven't necessarily made that much of a dent in emissions globally because we're basically just outsourcing the oil and the gas to all the worst people imaginable. Like, we're cutting back our productions at home, but we're begging Maduro, we're begging MBS to open up their own spigots. Now, I guess that's oil, that's not gas, but whenever you shut down oil or gas production domestically, that doesn't necessarily curtail demand for that sort of good. You wanted to say something.
Yeah, no, that was great. Sorry to interrupt. But I mean, what I was going to say is the curtailment of CO2 emissions has come from places like France, where they've shifted from, you know, fossil fuel energies, oil and gas and coal, in the case of Germany, to nuclear power, which you know, lots of the green states in Europe have refused to do. Whereas, you know, you can see on a per capita basis, France has made significantly more reductions in their CO2 emissions than the other countries. So it's not like you can't do this. It's like you can't do this well, simply denying domestic exploration of these energy resources and then hoping and praying that green energy will take its place without the technology simply not there. You could use nuclear as a bridge for however length of time it takes for the battery capacity of green energy to ramp up, all these sorts of things, which we can discuss more. But it's not just that Europe as a whole has been unsuccessful in achieving reductions in CO2.
Remind me to come back to the nuclear point that you just made, because that's a very excellent one. I've got another like piece of evidence I'd like to lay on top of that. But before I do that, I want to highlight the importance of, like, I know I already characterized Russia as a gas station with an army, right? People may not have been paying attention at the granular level that you and I have been, Sam, but after Russia got hit with all the sanctions that it did post-invasion, everyone sort of assumed its economy to implode, and it didn't. In fact, the ruble bounced back. Well, after that initial dip, it bounced back even stronger. And a big part of the reason that was is because oil and gas prices had shot up so much because of the war, and Russia still had a market to export those goods, primarily through India and China. So it's like it's literally due to these two commodities that Russia, like the price of these commodities, that Russia is able to keep its economy afloat, keep its banks functioning. I mean, there's also a lot of liquidity coming in from Chinese banks. Again, too broad for this episode, but this is a big.
But if
big,
you are
big,
interested, check out our sister podcast, the Synopsis Podcast, in which we discuss the relationship between China and Russia and cover exactly this topic. But sorry.
But anyway, I just want to like really stress the importance of this. This is where the money for this blood machine is coming, and we left ourselves wide open to it. And it's not like the Americans weren't telling the Europeans they were doing this all along. Now might be a really good time to play that. To play the Trump quote that we've been giggling about for a while. Polarizing figure that he is. Here he is.
Very prescient in this case.
Here he is back in 2019 meeting with the Germans, and he was exactly right.
It's very sad when Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia where you're supposed to be guarding against Russia, and Germany goes out and pays billions and billions of dollars a year to Russia. But how can you be together when a country is getting its energy from the person you want protection against or from the group that you want protection against?
Because we understand that when we stand together, also when dealing with Russia, we are stronger.
Exactly. You know, so Orange Man Bad happened to be Orange Man Right in this case, as it turns out. Very predictive of the future. We'll repeat this a couple more times, but
that was the German delegation laughing at him at the end, by the way, in case that wasn't
yes.
clear.
Laughs in Germany.
As much as they laugh in Germany.
Yeah, exactly.
So unless you had something you wanted to say, I wanted to touch the
yes,
nuclear thing
One very quick thing. Just wanted to draw two counterpoints to the quotes that we've been citing thus far. One of which was that, is again from the same research that we were doing, one of which a Polish foreign ministry official said in response to the reporting done that with respect to shale and natural gas, it's all about geography and whether or not you can extract the gas profitably. As we'll discuss a little bit later on in this episode, Europe does have tremendous reserves of both oil and natural gas for it to exploit. Now, whether or not they could do so economically profitably is a question. We'll get to that later. But they did say that just because there are the reserves doesn't necessarily mean they can get it out of the ground at making a profit. And lastly, Greenpeace, who was cited as the antagonist in this episode, responded with very harsh words towards NATO, saying, quote, "You have to wonder what they're smoking over there at NATO HQ," which is, you know, very apropos coming from Greenpeace. So,
okay, so to finally bring it back to the nuclear thing that I was thinking about, and this is, I know we just came full circle by offering those two counterpoints or those two counterquotes that we found, but you know, they can say whatever they want. I want to reference a 1985 Time magazine article. So this was in the wake of so shale gas has, or like fracking more broadly, has been a major threat to Russia's energy dominance in Europe. They know that. You know what was the major threat before that? It was nuclear fusion power and our advancements towards that. And then a little thing called Three Mile Island happened with the nuclear reactor that melted down in New Jersey back in 1979. And immediately the Russians jumped on top of this. So there was this big, by now, like well-debunked myth called the nuclear winter hypothesis that basically hypothesizes that, you know, in the event of a nuclear exchange, you'd have so much dust and dirt kicked into the atmosphere that it would blacken the sky and freeze the world and block all the UV rays, right? Lose all vegetation, lose all life on the planet. Okay, so countless of high-intensity modelings later have revealed that it wouldn't quite be that extreme. It wouldn't be pretty, but it's not going to be quite that bad. Not saying that we should go to nuclear war or anything, but Russian propaganda hopped on top of that hypothesis and boosted the crap out of it. I'm trying to find the quote that, like, the CIA was basically – the CIA, MI5, and MI6 were all on record as saying, like, yeah, Russian propaganda is boosting this. And again, this 1985 Time magazine article noted, quote, "The suspicions of some Western scientists that the nuclear winter hypothesis was promoted by Moscow to give anti-nuclear groups in the U.S. and Europe some fresh ammunition against America's arms buildup," right? Directly, like, intentionally – muddling the waters between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, because at this time we were like in the fever pitch of let's all disarm nuclear. Reagan had his big treaty that he solidified with the Soviets. Sergei Tretiakov claimed that the data behind the nuclear winter scenario was faked by the KGB and spread in the West as part of a campaign against Pershing II missiles. He said that the first peer-reviewed paper on the development of nuclear winter hypothesis, which was called Twilight by Noon by a guy called Paul Crutzen and John Birx, was published as a result of this KGB influence.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the important thing to take away from all that excellent information that you just laid out there is that this has been almost the gold standard of the Kremlin disinformation playbook for going back as far as that was a thing, really. Like, you know, spreading ideas and, you know, kind of aligning with pre-existing movements that are already out there in the ether and boosting their intensity, giving them money, giving them credibility, echoing them. You know, RT, Russia Today, obviously loves to play the most extreme narratives from both sides. And, you know, you saw all those stories about, like, you know, the 2016 Facebook ads of, you know, blah, 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 and fighting and, you know, political stuff and all that. This is really it should not be a surprise to anyone paying attention that this was the same playbook that Russia used with regards to energy as they've done for everything else, I guess is the point that I'm trying to make here.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Little known fact, the Soviet Union pumped more money and energy into boosting American anti-war movements than it actually gave to the Viet Cong. And, you know, the Soviet Union provided the Viet Cong with their entire military arsenal.
I mean, as it turns out, that was an effective calculation, I think.
It turns out they were exactly right, because we lost Vietnam because of politics. We didn't lose Vietnam because of military incapability.
Yeah. I mean, the military incapability was tied to our domestic political decisions, but
we can punch each other over that later.
Exactly. Yeah. no, that's good. I mean, anything else you want to hit there? Because I want to talk about some infrastructure.
Go for it. Let's do it.
Okay, cool. You know, so I think hopefully by now you understand that this is a direct Kremlin plot, ploy, idea to foster the Western Europe's energy dependence on Russia. So let's talk about the knock-on effects of that, because you may have heard in the news that very recently, Europe has shifted to start trying to import some LNG, liquefied natural gas, from the rest of the world. But infrastructure is a big deal. It's expensive, it's time-consuming, and it's difficult to come online. So why do I say that? Well, you can't just import LNG. It doesn't just like, oh, here's a box of LNG. Here you go. Let's just plug it into our thing and off you go. No. There is a whole well beyond my capacities to talk about, but there's a lot of money, time, infrastructure that it takes to develop the capacities to store, transport, and utilize the LNG. So you may have seen some photos of tons of ships sitting off of various harbors in Europe, just stocked to the brims with this LNG. But Europe does not have the capacity to import it at the to import it onshore and into the storage facilities from the rate that it's being delivered on the ship. Europe's lack of capacity in this type of energy is a result of it tacking its capacity on to the other type, oil and gas from Russia, and the pipelines.
So as you were saying that, I was thinking about the scene in Breaking Bad where the good guys lock the bad guys in the back of a truck and bolt it shut, and basically shut all the air ventilation out and then start pumping it with CO2 until they quietly asphyxiate the dudes inside. So think about how long you might last inside such a room. It probably wouldn't be as quick as it was in the show, but it wouldn't be very long because gas in its gaseous state does not have a whole lot of mass, so you can't get a whole lot of energy from it. So when you transport natural gas, because they find it in gas and its state of nature, you have to freeze it, you have to condense it, you have to cool the crap out of it and maintain that and keep it compact into a liquid form to the point that it's basically taking up 1/1000th of the space that it normally would. So you can't exactly do that easily in a truck, right? So the only cost-effective ways to transport this stuff is via pipelines. That's the number one option. If you can't do pipelines, you got to use ships. But the only way to use ships is to, trade the gas off at specialized liquid natural gas terminals. These things are, I don't know, multi-million, potentially billion-dollar projects that take like many, many years to complete. You can't just flip the switch overnight and start importing natural gas from the next supplier once the infrastructure has been built up, to your earlier point.
Exactly. Yeah, so I mean, I said it before, but the point is like Europe doesn't have the infrastructure because it chose to invest in other infrastructure. I mean, you know, there's other things that Europe's doing that's shooting itself in the foot energy-wise, which is despite importing all of this LNG, they are choosing to do so on very short-term contracts, years at a time, as opposed to much longer, you know, 10-plus-year leases on the energy, which, you know, if you know anything about, I mean, think about like, you know, buying in bulk at Costco versus going to the corner store and buying the same item. It's going to be more expensive if you buy a smaller individual quantity of it. And it's the same with energy. So even as they're importing it, they're not getting the best price because, and we'll get to this topic in a little bit, you know, there's still this fixation on green energy and, you know, Europe is trying to bridge the gap right now with LNG. But ultimately, the political class has decided that they want to not be reliant on LNG for the long term.
And you know what? Like, the phenomenon that you just mentioned, the fact that the Europeans are literally so allergic to the idea of signing a 10-year contract for gas that they're buying it by individual ships at an exorbitant price, like probably triple the price that they would have to per unit, it's a symptom of the intentional befuddlement, the intentional confusion of the real cost of quote-unquote dirty energy versus renewables in this case, some of which has been boosted by the Russian propaganda machine.
You know, so we're going to be doing a lot of ragging on Europe in this episode because, boy, howdy, is there a lot to rag on. Looking at you, in particular, Germany, the worst country in Europe for a whole lot of reasons. Not really, but but you know, let's take aim at good old U.S. of A., our domestic homeland. And you know, we've had some relatively crackpot energy policy lately, especially given the invasion of Ukraine. You know, the Biden administration put a moratorium on the extension of new leases for energy exploration on federal land. Obviously, at the beginning of Biden's term, there was the shutting down of the Keystone XL pipeline, which admittedly was not during the active invasion of Ukraine. But again, you know, as we're talking about the reliance on, and Mike made reference to the fact that, you know, the Biden administration is courting the Maduros, the MBSs, Mohammed bin Salman from Saudi Arabia, who the Biden administration vowed to make an international pariah after the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist. It basically points to a very confused and conflicting policy on energy that doesn't, if the defense and supporting of Ukraine is the number one geostrategic goal, then you're engaged in all of these policies which don't really align with that, is how I would put it.
Mm-hmm. And not long after he axed the Keystone XL pipeline, he lifted the sanctions on Nord Stream 2 in part to curry favor with the Germans.
Yeah. That's so bad. It's so bad.
I'm trying to keep a straight face while doing this.
No. That's really funny. Let's expand. Let's just clarify, make crystal clear what exactly that is, because that is ass backwards policy, to put it mildly. Again, Biden nixed the
Keystone XL pipeline from Canada.
Exactly. Which would be, you know, same thing, transporting energy from one country to another, and then allowed the final construction slash operation of the same thing, an energy pipeline between Russia and
the
Germany.
Rest of our, and the rest of our NATO allies, like our key NATO allies.
Exactly.
So now we're at a point where we don't have a whole lot of clean alternatives left. And he still isn't lifting the moratorium on new energy exploration on federal land. Not only that, but we're tapping into the strategic oil reserve. Okay, now this has been done a few times, but the scale at which we're doing it now has not been seen ever.
It's bad. Just looking at
the chart,
the image
is a cliff. The chart is an absolute cliff. Like, this is supposed to be our wartime reserve of oil to keep our economy afloat in the event of World War III, right?
Well, and no. Actually, what more than that? It's not even to keep our economy afloat. It is the strategic petroleum reserve. It is used, like you said, in times of war for national defense and essential, like, keeping some heat on while suspending domestic production. It is not used to slightly lower the cost of energy, and it hasn't really even done so. Like, you may have heard all these stories over the past year of, oh, Biden's tapping into the strategic petroleum reserve and blah, blah, bringing prices down. It is a relatively large amount of energy, but on the global market for energy and oil, it is not enough to significantly move the price, while at the same time depleting our capacity to be self-sufficient in the event of the absolute unthinkable, you know, a war that heavily involves the United States. Sorry, off my soapbox.
No. He's doing all that instead of just changing America's energy policy to be something a little bit more sensible. At least, again, I don't want to wear my colors too hard on my sleeve right now, because I'm no friend of the other side of the aisle at this point either, given the current climate. But this is,
yeah. But you got to call out stupid where it is.
But you do got to call out stupid where it is, and this is really stupid. This is robbing us of our strategic leverage for his political gain, and he did so like during, you know, election season, and I don't know if it's going to continue into the next season, but.
Well,
anyways,
it can't continue by virtue of the fact that we don't have any energy left. Our reserves are like below 1970s levels right now.
And like you said, we went from sanctioning Mohammed bin Salman because of the like axe murder of a Washington Post journalist inside their consulate in Turkey, right? We went from doing that to like the most recent visit that Biden went. He greeted Mohammed bin Salman with a fist bump and tried to be all buddy-buddy with him. And we sent a delegation to the Venezuelans, as I alluded to earlier. It's just like, we're not actually reducing oil production. We're just outsourcing it to the worst people imaginable.
Exactly. Sent
a delegation. Pretending to wash our hands clean of it in the process, which we're not.
Sent a delegation to Venezuela while not recognizing the government of Maduro, while still maintaining that the government in exile, quote unquote, of Juan Guaido is a legitimate government of Venezuela. So, you know, the depravity has no bounds.
And it's not like Russia was tying their hands behind their back this entire time while we were doing it.
Yeah. So kind of on this, is there anything else you want to cover on this topic? Because I do want to talk about Europe's reluctance to explore its own energy briefly.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah. So this is a topic that we've made reference to several times throughout the podcast. So I just want to put some numbers on it for you, dear listener. I'm going to present three sets of numbers, Europe, Russia, and the USA, in terms of trillion cubic feet of natural gas and then billions of barrels of oil. So Europe has 600 and 18 respectively. Russia has 280 and 75 respectively, and Europe has 625 and 70 and 80 respectively. So to put it in perspective, that's a lot of energy. Europe has more than 8% of the entire world's expected reserves of natural gas, and, you know, not very much oil, fine, but compare that natural gas to Russia, which is, again, Russia exports its natural gas to Europe, and it only has 3.75% of the world's known reserves of natural gas. So Europe has, on the European continent, excluding Russia, Europe has more than double the natural gas energy reserves when compared to Russia. Now, again, as we mentioned, whether or not that can be extracted profitably, that's an open question. And that 8.2% compares almost exactly the same to the United States. And the U.S. actually has more oil in the ground than Russia by a little bit as well. So... you know, suffice it to say that if it really was an imperative for the European continent, they could get their own energy, but they've made political decisions not to. And that's kind of what we want to talk a little bit more about here. Mike, if you wanted to jump in or anything, otherwise I can keep ranting.
Oh, no, you're good. My head is like still on the whole. Go for it. Let's do it.
Okay. Yeah, cool. And, you know, so another thing I talked about with regards to green energy is even within the scope of renewables and all that sort of stuff, or clean energy broadly, there are decisions that you can make. For instance, The Economist quotes France as having almost 70% of its energy from nuclear energy, which, let's be clear, whatever concerns you might have about meltdowns, Fukushima, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, all that sort of stuff, the actual emissions from nuclear energy, excluding the waste, day-to-day, is zero. It produces water vapor, clean water vapor. And, you know, if your number one concern is CO2 emissions and your next words out of your mouth are not nuclear energy, you are not being a serious person. Full stop. It is as simple as that. The tech, one of the main problems with green energy, renewable energy, solar, wind, obviously, hydropower as well, although to a lesser extent, solar and wind is the fact that our battery capacity technology is not there to support these energy. The sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And the issue is that we cannot store that productive capacity when we're not generating it. Like, the battery technology is simply not there. If you look at, Tesla, the most popular electric car out there on the market, by far the heaviest, largest, most expensive component of it is the battery that lies entirely flat along the bed of the whole car. Replacing it is something like a fifth of the cost of the entire car. It's just our battery capacity is not there. And therefore, talking about green energy without a discussion of nuclear or advancements in battery technology is a fool's errand. Rant over. Please say some words.
No, I mean, you pretty much got it. I mean, one of the things that's really frustrating watching this unfold in Europe is that, you know, you might take a semi-successful example like, I don't know, Arizona or maybe California, to pick a better one, where they actually do get a lot of sunshine year-round and they do get some decent wind. Or the UK, which is like, I think, the windiest location on planet Earth by and large. But then you go to Germany. Have you been to Germany? Like, the sun doesn't shine a tremendous amount in Germany. Like, they have, God, I forget, I would have to pull up the statistics. If you look at the average number of sunny days in Germany or Amsterdam or any of these other places, or the UK, God help you, it's not going to be anywhere near what we have in the southwest of the United States, where there are solar panels everywhere powering people's homes. Like, you just cannot translate that solution over to there. But because of the hype and the Greta Thunberg and all, like, they thought that they could get away with it. They thought that it was their moral imperative to do so. Again, see the earlier, confusion between natural gas emissions and dirty energy emissions. By the way, natural gas is not particularly dirty when you burn it.
Compare it to coal, especially, which Germany has opened up their coal power plants because let's be very clear. Like, Mike said the words moral imperative, and whatever your political moral position on green energy is, it is not there. And again, Mike said it earlier on in this episode. Just because you want to shift towards those energy sources, there has not been a corresponding curtailment of individual or company use of the other fuel sources. The energy consumption in Europe, obviously excluding relatively recently, has basically remained flat while shifting its energy production away from domestic or friendly sources like the United States towards openly antagonistic sources like the Russians. So it's like the moral argument or whatever of clean energy doesn't even make sense because you're not being clean. Again, let me just put some numbers to be clear. Germany emits almost 8 metric tons per capita compared to France, which does 4.5, almost half. Where does that difference come from? It comes from France's use of nuclear energy. If CO2 emissions are your major concern, you need to actually take efficacious steps to curtail those emissions. Otherwise, you are just being a clown show. I don't know how else to say this.
Yeah, and just to be clear about this, let's see, the population of France is what exactly? Germany's about 80, 85 million. France is 67.5 million.
I did per capita, so.
Oh, yeah. Cool, nice, good
yeah,
for you.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I was going to say, like, it's a little bit behind, but it's not that far behind. Certainly not half.
We're comparing France and Germany because these are the two, the twin engines of Europe, as they're called, comparable in terms of population, GDP, all that sort of stuff. And France has it right and Germany has it wrong if your concern is the reduction in CO2. And it's not like they're making it up mystically through other means or whatever. Their uses of non-nuclear, non-CO2 emitting sources of energy are basically comparable. Germany actually comes in a little bit higher at 17% of its energy production from there, whereas France is only 13. Again, the difference is nuclear and not relying on German energy and now increasingly, Russian energy, and now increasingly dirty coal power plants. Again, Germany shut down its nuclear plants to fire up its coal plants. Well, while still maintaining that the reduction of CO2 emissions is their chief concerns. I don't know how else to say it other than clown show, because that is pants on head retarded.
Very well said. I think...
I'm getting exercised on this topic.
As you should. I had a feeling you were going to run away with this particular section, which is great. Because I don't have nearly as much to say on it.
It's you know, I have some historical reasons to be distrust and be angry at Germany, shall we say.
Sam's Jewish.
Now they're making more stupid decisions. All right, let's move off this topic before I blow a gasket. Is there anything else you want to cover in this episode before we start wrapping it up?
I would like to cap things off by highlighting one more piece of evidence to our earlier point. So a lot of the examples, like we talked about funding of anti-war movements in Vietnam. We talked about anti-nuclear movements in the 80s. We talked about the anti-fracking thing in 2014, like post-annexation of Crimea. There was an even more recent example in 2017 of an open letter written to, I think it was the Department of the Treasury, where like, several people got together. Like the title of this video, the title of this letter is Russia's Propaganda War Against Fossil Fuels. And it goes on for like, it's pretty brief. It's like 6 pages. But in it, like they cite a few examples of like multi-million dollar like money laundering operations, most of which are going through like Bermuda or the UK, where these NGOs are, or like whoever is like cleaning the money, so to speak, and then passing it on to the Sea Change Foundation. Who else was listed here? So in this letter, like they allege, in fact, they basically prove that the Russians were funneling money mostly through entities in Bermuda, because for whatever reason, like Bermuda, Panama, and Liechtenstein, or however you pronounce it.
Cayman Islands, Liechtenstein, yeah.
Yeah, they're not required to disclose their donors' identities or countries of origin. In contrast, like the United States does not allow something like that to happen. So a lot of money gets laundered in these areas and then funneled into American NGOs, European NGOs. One of the major recipients of this money has been something called the Sea Change Foundation, which has been a major U.S.-based 501c3, that being a private foundation, an NGO, that I think was founded back in the like either the 60s or the 70s. It was like up there with the ranks of Greenpeace in terms of like size and scope in the environmental movement. But yeah, they're alleging that they received up to like $95 million in laundered Russian money. And so Greenpeace has no idea even necessarily this is going on. They just see the money coming in from various dispersed NGOs or private donors or whatever, but it's being funneled to them unwittingly through these entities in these other countries that I mentioned, like Bermuda. Anyways, I just wanted to mention that like this has been brought to the attention of the government in the United States, more recent than 2014, and we've chosen to ignore it.
Yeah, I just two addendums. One, again, keep in mind the framework of bootleggers and Baptists. I want to be very clear: we are not calling out Greenpeace or any other similar green organizations for being openly antagonistic or stooges or whatever, or maybe stooges is the right word. But we're not saying that they're conspiring with the Russians. Rather, there is a collusion of interests here, again, bootleggers and Baptists, that there is nefarious intent matched with pure intent, and the nefarious intent is basically co-opting and using the pure intent. Whether or not you agree with that, that's open for your own political consideration, but we're not slamming them here. The other thing is I just want to read another quote from this letter, which is part and parcel with the quotes I was reading earlier on, just really to give you background on what the intelligence sources are saying with regard. This is not our analysis. This is, from NATO, the U.S. government, all this sort of stuff. And this is a 2017 letter from the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology to the Treasury of the United States, the Secretary Steve Mnuchin at the time. And the quote being, quote, Russia has been using a mix of hard and soft power to maintain European dependence on imported Russian gas. There it is. And, said it a million times this episode, going to say it a million more times. As you can see, this has led to disastrous consequences. If Europe was not, tied at the hip to Russia, I don't think Russia would have had the cojones to muster its invasion, because it knew that, like, there would have been more universal condemnation and, not shifting topics entirely, but this is one of the major concerns about Taiwan. We do another podcast on China, and the fact that China is so integrated into the world's economy, far more so than Russia. Yeah, Russia supplies energy to the world, but China, think about how much of your stuff you own is made in China. And the fact that is so leads, you know, many observers and analysts to question whether or not there would be even as forceful of a response as we've seen from Western Europe to Russia, from the rest of the world to China, if there were to be an invasion of Taiwan. But that's obviously far outside the scope of this episode, but it is worth drawing a parallel to. Anything else?
No, I think that's all the time we have for today.
All right. Yeah. So with that, we wanted to thank all our listeners for tuning into yet another episode of the Ukrainian Provcast. Our next episode that we do will most likely be our mailbag, where we answer all the questions that we've received from you over the course of the show. So please email us your questions or vitriolic hate mail at theukrainianprovcast@gmail.com. Once again, that is theukrainianprovcast@gmail.com. No spaces, no periods, no nothing. And if your question is as just plain hateful, conspiring against Germany, and anti-EU as the rest of the content on the show, we will read it on the air because that is exactly the sort of stuff we're looking for in this podcast. So on behalf of Mike and I, we'll be back again with another episode soon. But in the meantime, keep up the fight. The Ukrainian Provcast is co-hosted by Sam Bach and Michael Williamson. Audio production by Mark Fusito. Artwork by Eli Bach.